From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for January 10th, 2020. It's time to hit the road. The RV and camping show is at the Wisconsin Center this weekend. Your Milwaukee Bucks host the New York Knickerbockers Tuesday night, and in an all-important playoff game, the Packers play the Seattle Seahawks Sunday night at Lambeau. Well, driving in New York City is crazy, and parking is crazier still, so check this out. As of the first of the year, the New York City parking meters had a software glitch that won't allow them to take credit cards. And of course, it's costing the city a large bunch of money. Well, the city's IT guys are on the job and individually reprogramming all 14,000 parking meters. Like, that won't take forever. A good guy wanted to surprise his grandma with a bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream for New Year's. Harvey's Bristol Cream should give you a clue to Granny's age. Well, an Amazon driver didn't deliver it because the 92-year-old woman didn't have a photo ID that proved she was over 21. So either she didn't have a fake ID or Granny is smoking hot for her age. Let's give her the benefit of the doubt. And how about this for a lawsuit? A woman is suing Blue Buffalo Dog Food Company, claiming the dog food is making her dog fat. So if you want to put Rover on a diet, just remember, it's one call, that's all. In the studio today, we have Art Rothschild, Dave Sandstrom, Paige Ratke, Joel Driesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. A busy week this week and another busy week next week as we kick off earnings season. We'll jump right into the numbers and then I think quite a bit to talk about today. So for the week, Dow Jones Industrial Average finished the week up 0.7%, closing at 28,823, but down 134 points today. The NASDAQ up 1.8% to close at 91.79, and the S&P 500 up 30 points to close this week at 0.9%. And that's a quick look at the week. Joel, I think maybe a good place to start this week is with you and some of the economic data, and in particular some employment news out today. Going on now 10 consecutive years of job gains.
Yeah, Kyle, it's actually 122 consecutive months now that employers have added jobs in the country, and that's more than double the previous record. It's a lot of the things that we're looking at. We're seeing sort of the same theme, and that's that continued growth, but it's slowing down. So we added 2.1 million jobs, give or take, in 2019. That was down from 2.7 million in 2018. That's still a lot of jobs, and it's still good news. But it's showing that, as sort of a marathon runner, as you're getting further along, you don't have as much energy.
And obviously, I think important to point out the role that the employment picture has had for the Fed and allowing the Fed to continue to keep rates where they are, actually lowering them three times last year and likely continuing to keep them where they are this year. We had comments from the president of the Chicago Fed this week, Charles Evans, talking about how the expectation was that we'd make it through 2020 now without any interest rate change. And so, in the absence of any, real wage growth, some modest wage growth, but not the kind of wage growth that you'd think would fuel inflation. With an employment picture that's been good, great at times, but now starting to slow down a little bit, perhaps that's more fuel for the Fed to keep things where they are.
Yeah, and he actually made those remarks when he was in Milwaukee this week, and one of the things that he pointed out was actually a year ago when he made the forecast, he was expecting that they were going to raise interest rates, and they did just the opposite. One of the things in the jobs report today that was worth noting, and again, always say you have to take these reports with a grain of salt because they correct them up to two months later, and then after that they do a big look back at all of the numbers. But one of the numbers that stood out to me was it's the first month since the middle of 2018 when the year-to-year average wage gain wasn't above 3%. And we've been waiting for those wage gains to come along, and finally it looked like they were. And now this month, there's a sign that maybe, we're going to go back down again.
I don't know, Joel. There are some other things going on with wages that we might actually start to see again going into 2020. One thing to note is while the federal minimum wage has stayed the same for much of the past couple decades, there's been a couple of states that have come out and actually increased their minimum wage. So we're starting to see states take things into their own hands and increase that here and there. The other thing is construction workers. Construction companies have been cited saying that they just simply can't find enough skilled workers. So the more that we build and the more infrastructure spending that we have, the more they're going to have to pay more to try to attract those skilled workers.
Yeah, Paige, those are good points. I'm sorry. 21 states and 26 cities mm-hmm. are raising minimum wage. And as far as the dilemma for construction industry and a lot of industries, they're saying that they can't find the workers they need with the skills that they want, especially at the wages that they want to pay. So, we're coming to this this moment, I think, when, either you have to pay more or figure out what else to do. And sometimes that results in technological innovations that can help in the longer run. But the other thing, another number that I looked at today was the labor force participation rate, which is basically saying, who in the population that's able to work, that could work, is in the workforce. And it's been 63% or so for the past few years. It's lower than it was going into the recession. It was 66%. We're basically back where we were 40 years ago. And that, I think, there are lots of stories out of that. But one of them is demographics. And that's something that we can't do a lot about, is the demographics. There just aren't enough people. And that's going to be something to reckon with in coming years.
Maybe just to bring this employment picture back into kind of why it matters for our investors and talk about, how the employment allows the employment picture allows the Fed to keep rates low. And remember that if you're a stock investor, low rates help support higher stock prices. And so what you hope, at least in the short run, is that, the Fed can help us overcome some of the overvaluation we've had in stocks, some of the expansion of the multiple that we've had in the stocks, which, gives us some cover for earnings to come back as long as interest rates can stay low. I think obviously we for a while looked at new market highs as this novel thing, and then we kind of got used to market tops. We kind of got used to this idea that every couple of days the S&P was going to set a new record, and so Thursday we get a new market close, not a lot of press written about how it's this, another new market close. And I think a lot of it had to do with, how much else is going on in the world right now with Iran, with China, with the Chinese trade war, with a lot of stuff coming out of Washington. And so, I wonder, maybe this one's for the table, what kinds of questions we're getting from clients, what kind of questions you're getting from clients, but more importantly, how you're positioning portfolios in light of the fact that it seems like now a new market top is just something that we're expecting here, and maybe not something that, longer term is what could be sustainable.
Well, Kyle, I'll jump in on that one. And I think, one good word for this time in the market cycle, I think, is caution. And I think that, what we've seen last year, the stock increases we saw in 2019 have gathered a lot of the attention. And what you don't hear a lot about is what could even be described as even a more impressive rally in bond prices. And so while stocks are glamorous and exciting, bonds kind of play that boring role in your portfolio. And it's going to be tough going forward with that type of an increase in bond prices this year. So, we're talking about sticking to the higher quality issues in the bonds and maybe being able to extend durations a little bit now, seeing that the Fed is committed to this stance on keeping rates steady or low. So I think it isn't a time to jump all in at these market at peaks and really pay attention to having a very good positioned, high quality bond portfolio.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to talk about what you should be doing, as you suggested, in general to position yourself for things that we don't expect. What happened this week geopolitically was something we'd never heard of. I mean, a hit on an Iranian general in Iraq. I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? It looked like the market was going to implode, but it didn't. The question was what was going to be the reaction. And I think, quite frankly, we should spend more time when we look at our portfolios looking at, as you suggest, how they're constructed so that we can get through anything, even market highs, You know, if the stock market doesn't go higher in a week or two, who cares? Because you should expect stocks to go do well over long periods of time. One of my favorite marketing pieces from, we can't talk about a specific fund, but from an old fund that's been around a long, long time, suggests to us that no matter what has happened in the past, stocks have always gone higher. We're talking World War II, we're talking, you know, Pearl Harbor, we're talking, in more recent memory, the Great Recession. And I keep track statistically of what's happened since the Great Recession. And I get a kick out of this one. Forget about the, you know, just the geopolitical. But the S&P 500, as of the end of December, was up 377% from March 9th of 2009. And that's despite whatever's happened in between. From October 9th of 2007, which was when we peaked before the Great Recession, that same index is still up 106%. So my point is, your stocks, as we've always discussed, are in your portfolio to make money over long periods of time. And despite the fact that we don't know what's going to happen to interest rates, and even though bonds do go up and down, and even though this may be a favorable time period for longer maturity, bonds are slightly increasing your duration, we always use fixed income to provide stability, which gets us through these periods of time in which we have concerns about the geopolitical environment and potential world war, for example.
You know, I think the focus on safe money, the focus on stability right now is such a critical piece. And so I would say frustrated yesterday when I had a meeting with a prospect who brought me his statements, showed me he's got 21 positions in his largest account. 10 of the 21 positions were high-yield bond funds. So forget for a second what you're doing with 10 positions that are all shooting at the same target. Pick one, obviously, and pick the one you think is going to do the best. Why do you need 10 that does it? But the second part of that is, if our conversations here are about the role of bonds as safe money, the role of, you know, that piece of your portfolio is the piece that's supposed to get you through, that's supposed to allow you to see beyond the next year, beyond the next 3 years, and to, you know, Art, as you rightfully point out, you know, how have we done the last 10 years? How have we done the last 50? How have we done the last 100? If you've got a long enough time horizon, and I think for many of our investors, their time horizon is far beyond even their own lives. You know, the bond piece is the piece you need. The stock piece is the piece that you can rely on 10 years down the road. And so when I saw that portfolio and kind of leaned into that conversation about, you know, I understand the appeal for high yield. You know, you look this year, high yield's up 2019, high yield was up 13.5%, 14%. Bonds as a whole, though, were up, you know, 8 or 9%, depending on what you're investing in. And so you didn't get all that much more to go to high yield. And then I think you look at how bad can it get when it gets bad for junk bonds, when it gets bad for high yield. You're talking about down 30% or more in the financial crisis. You're talking about a year, you know, even without cherry picking the worst year that's out there, you're talking about years that are down 4 or 5 when the aggregate bond index is up, you know, 2, 3, or maybe just flat, but at least you didn't lose money. And you know that if I need to take money tomorrow, okay, I've got something to take it from. And high yield's not that place. And so, you know, I think we've talked on this podcast a lot about kind of the role that bonds should play. We've talked about how you just don't get compensated for the risk right now. And I think the one thing to point out is that there will be a time down the road when high yield makes sense again. There'll be a time down the road when other asset classes that maybe don't make sense right now make their way back into our portfolios in some form or fashion. But I think, you know, we have to be more cautious right now, Dave, as you rightfully point out, Art, as you rightfully point out.
The unfortunate truth, though, is you're probably dealing with a consumer who didn't know what he had. And so he told his advisor he wanted safety, so the guy put him in bonds because they're safer than stocks, is what he could have been told, without telling about the risk in the bonds he was getting. So we're not going to construct a portfolio that way. That's why it's very important to choose who you choose to help you make intelligent decisions and make sure you understand what you've got, as well as who's given it to you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Art. I certainly don't blame the investor on that one. It was absolutely the advisor who put them in that portfolio. And more likely it was some team that put together a portfolio, some model that said any client that comes in and asks for this gets stuck into that model. Yeah, and I think one more reason why maybe the conversation has to be a little deeper than just, what's your risk tolerance, but really getting down to who you are as a person and what you need to build a portfolio that's right for you, not just what's right for the average investor. You know, obviously, a lot of other economic data this week, Joel, in particular, news on The trade deficit, which was a pretty big deal earlier in the week. Anything in particular stand out to you from the economic data?
So there was that. We had, you know, the trade deficit that actually went down 8.2% in November from October. There's a lot of volatility in that because of, you know, what's going on with tariffs and things like that. Actually, one of the numbers in there was that exports rose in November, so that could help the GDP number for the fourth quarter because, you know, you look at the net export number in there and that would be good for the GDP. There was a report from the Institute for Supply Management on their non-manufacturing index. That was up, you know, we talked about employment up for 10 years running, and this index showed that the non-manufacturing part of our economy, which is the largest part of our economy, has been growing for 122 months straight. So that's pretty impressive. Again, it's not, you know, going at the as fast a pace as it has been in recent years, but it was the highest it was since August, and that was a good sign.
Anything else, you know, from the economic front, Joel, that stands out? Obviously, we talked about the employment stuff a little bit. We talked about, you know, trade deficit here. I think consumer credit for me is one that's a big deal as we look at kind of the direction of the U.S. consumer and maybe how well we can support the economy down the road. Obviously, the data may be a little bit more dated than some of the other stuff we look at, though.
Yeah, and so, you know, one of the things that the Fed has kept pointing out is that the consumer spending, which accounts for about 70% of economic activity in our country, that's been pretty solid. And that's because the employment situation's been solid. People feel good about their jobs. Even if their wages aren't going up that fast, you know, they feel pretty good about spending, so that's good. The consumer credit number showed that credit card debt for November stepped back about 2.7%. So, again, you don't know from a month's numbers what exactly that means, but it suggests that people are being cautious with their credit cards, that they're not you know, going all out and spending their, you know, what they have on their credit cards, which in the longer run is good for us because they're not, you know, they've still got some cash to burn. In the shorter term, it means that they're not spending money.
And Joel, to go alongside that, the household debt ratio numbers at a really good stance. If you look back 30 years, we're at a low point right now. And when I talk about debt service ratios, that's what you have available to spend at the end of the day in a household after you've taken care of your debt payments. Put in perspective, prior to the last recession, that number was 13% of everybody's take-home pay had to go to retire debt obligations. That's down below 10% right now. Yeah. And we haven't seen that since the 1980s. So again, to your point, leads us to believe that the consumer is in a pretty good position here to keep the economy continuing.
Well, that's why I think it's so important to look at not just the immediate benefit of credit spending sometimes, but also what's the long-term impact of, you know, retiring some of that debt versus just, you know, leveraging up your credit cards versus just spending on, you know, on those credit cards. And so, you know, yeah, short-term we could get a pretty big economic benefit from consumers going out and all buying new refrigerators and new TVs. And, you know, I think I've probably repeated 1,000 times how most households don't need that stuff right now. And so you need more household formation to make that spending necessary. But the other part of that is that if we do all that today, it means tomorrow we don't need to go out and buy new TVs and new refrigerators. And so encouraging to see not just that the, you know, the consumer spending numbers have been fairly solid, but also that the debt levels have come down a little bit.
And getting back to Paige's point before, you know, a lot of with those minimum wages going up, that's raising the wages for people on the lower end of the economic scale, and those are people who spend money. I mean, you put it in the pocket of somebody who's, you know, settled, and they're not as likely to spend it. But if it's somebody who needs more, that's going to go right into the economy.
Paige, anything in particular you're looking at right now? Anything that you're asking, you're being asked about?
Yeah, I mean, one thing just to point out is that I feel like a few months ago I was asked almost every single day, when's the recession coming or is there a recession coming? Now, suddenly, as we've talked about employment numbers and all these other things that are going on, I don't get asked that anymore. So I just think it's important to remember that, you know, not much has changed on that front. Jobs have been strong, and I expect them to continue to remain strong. But we are still seeing that weakness in the manufacturing sector, which clearly hasn't had as big of an impact on our economy overall. But there are still things out there to keep an eye out on. And, you know, just one other thing that we sort of glossed over a little bit about the Fed is, you know, they came out and said that they're not going to raise rates at all in 2020. They've all but committed to that. But I just want to remind people that just because the Federal Reserve isn't raising interest rates or lowering interest rates, that doesn't mean that they aren't doing anything. So the former Fed chair, Ben Bernanke, came out a couple weeks ago to talk about a paper that he wrote where he suggested that the other things that the Fed is doing, like repurchase agreements and just their public communication, could have up to a 3% impact on interest rates. So just one thing to keep in mind is just because rates are low, should we see something happen, the Fed still has tools in their toolbox, and they are implementing those tools still today.
That's a good point, Paige. I think it's more difficult for the average person to understand all the things that the Fed does. We look at the Fed and say, okay, they meet and they say, here's where rates are supposed to be, and that's their job. And the reality is that in addition to all the economic research that they publish, they're also in the markets every day trying to navigate liquidity, trying to make sure that things flow the way they're supposed to. I think the other thing that really stood out to me about what you just said regarding clients not really asking about recession anymore is that in a lot of ways, the breadth that recession gives to markets, we've seen. You know, Art, you and I were talking earlier about the fourth quarter of 2018 transitioning to 2019, how, you know, when you've got a quarter in which you're down 13, 14, 15%, and at times we were down close to 20%, that's just about a bear market. Yeah, maybe technically we didn't get there, but what's the difference between 19.5 and 20 if only, you know, a half a percent, and it means we don't get to technically say we made a bear market? And then the other is that, you know, we had an earnings recession. And so we've seen some of the things we typically would see. We just haven't seen it on the economic front yet. And so, you know, I think worth pointing out that, you know, maybe even though we keep saying this is as long as an expansion as it's been, it's the longest bull market that we've seen, maybe we have seen some things that can put that in a little more perspective.
Taking that just a step further is, you know, looking at, we talk about the length of this expansion, but we don't really talk about the actual amount that we've expanded, right? So comparing it to the past expansions, it's been pretty moderate. It hasn't been as big of economic growth that we've seen in the past. So even though it's been long, the actual amount is still not really where we've seen it in the past.
Yeah, Kyle, I want to address the point you just made that we talked about with respect to last year versus this year. Psychology's changing. What a difference a year makes. We are victims of our most recent experience. So last year in the fourth quarter, people were devastated. The S&P dropped nearly 15%, you know, within one quarter.
Let's say 2018.
Last year, meaning 2018. Thank you. 2019, we went up as much as we went down the year before, and we just had the best year, meaning 2019, since 2013. And so people are feeling good. They're going to spend more money. That's good on the economic front as well. The other thing is, it's just the fact that you never know what's going to happen or when. So you can't time this. You can't get in and get out before things happen. So as we've been saying, as I've been saying all along, it's important to stay balanced, stay diversified, expect to make money, you know, over time. And this could be a good time, you know, being influenced by what's going on. In the start of the year, with all the volatility we've had, we're up 1% for the year. It's a good start for a week.
Very little to complain about, for sure. Well, with a snowstorm on the way, plenty of reasons to stay inside this weekend. Hopefully give the podcast a listen and maybe go back and see what kinds of things might be in our old newsletters, things that might be of interest to you. As always, we appreciate you joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.